Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Cutting the Curd is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country? For more information, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
I'm Grace Bonney of After the Jump, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Cutting the Curd, broadcasting live on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Gregory Blaze, and I'm really excited for today's episode because I have not one, but two Cutting the Curd veterans in the studio with me today. With me to co-host is the estimable Diane Stemple, book reviewer extraordinaire. Hello, Diane. How are you today?
I'm very good. Thanks for having me.
And our guest today is a first-time guest, but many-time host, the creator and overlord of Cutting the Curd, Anne Saxelby. How are you today?
Overlord, I like that. I'm doing good. Thanks for having me on.
Well, welcome back to Roberta's. You are through the looking glass here. Up is down, black is white. Guests have become hosts. Hosts have become guests.
It's really
confusing.
What the
hell is going on?
It's really confusing. I don't know. Actually, it's so much has changed. When I was coming down Bogart Street to come to Roberta's, it's like Beacon's Closet is on Bogart Street.
Yes.
There are all these new businesses. There's a new taco place. I was like, what the hell is going on?
And there was no parking today. I couldn't find any parking.
I found a parking spot.
Well, I did too, but I had to go around the block. I've never had to do that before.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it feels like this is more bustling over here than, you know, where I came from. And you know, more central Brooklyn.
Where did you move?
We moved to Eastern Parkway.
Do you like
Prospect
it?
Prospect Heights. Yeah, it's really nice. Mm-hmm. It's really nice. It turns out, actually, Joan Rivers used to live in our building.
That's very odd.
It's so funny. Yeah, it's so weird.
You mean 2 days ago, right before she died?
Back in the day. Oh. Yeah, yeah. They, the Daily News ran this funny article today and interviewed our doorman, who's been here for like a million years, and uh-huh. He was talking about Joan Rivers and her family.
That must have been crazy. She must have some, I don't know. She's an eccentric, obviously. So
yeah, yeah. Who knows? She was a child, so I don't know if it was already coming out at that point or not.
I was down in your hood on Saturday as well. I was doing a little moonlighting at a cheese shop down in Crown Heights.
At Wedge, right?
Yeah. I was down there for a bit.
How was it?
It was neat. It was a tiny little shop, and it was really fun. I forgot how nice people were in Brooklyn in comparison to Manhattan.
Well, you got the tourists. You have the tourists in Manhattan.
I get everybody. I mean, literally, extraterrestrials. You know what I mean? People. I got them all.
What were you doing at Wedge?
Cheesemongering. And also, I visited for the first time the Brooklyn Larder, which I'd never been to, which I really loved.
It's a nice shop.
Yeah, and they made me a great meatball sub in there.
They have good food.
They really do. And I was really impressed. I mean, you know how it is in New York. It's like you're living in a bunch of different countries. So I live in Astoria, but I work in Manhattan. So there's really no reason for me to ever go to Brooklyn except for to come and record this radio show or to do things after the sun goes down. You know?
Totally.
I'm trying to eliminate portion of that from my life. So I don't get out to Brooklyn, and I just never needed to go to that part of Brooklyn, so I just never been to the Larder.
And since you're a cheesemonger, it's like you don't really do that on your day off. I feel like when I was first getting into cheese, I would go out and see every shop I could and visit every farmer's market I could and try everything. And then after a while, it's just like Yeah, I don't know. Sometimes on your day off, you want to do something different. So you don't always like go out and see everything you should.
No, you go home and you lie down because yeah. of time. That's actually good because I wanted to ask you and Saxelby. So you're quite a known entity in the cheese world, obviously. And you've helped tell the stories of like so many professionals. You've had so many people on the show. And you know, I feel like you've educated the world of cheese about so many people, but what I'd like to turn the tables on you a little bit and ask you about your own personal cheese journey. Like
uh-oh.
That's what's going to happen.
All right. Well, I'll try to keep it short and sweet. I don't want to bore anybody. But
oh, come on. On the edge of the
chair. Would you tell us about the roots of Saxelby cheesemongers, you know, and in your roots of cheesemongery?
Well, sure. Well, I guess, you know, it goes back to college. I went to NYU, and I grew up in the Midwest, and so I wasn't really exposed to any interesting cheese, really. I remember that when we went to the grocery store as a kid, if we got sliced white American from the deli, you know, not from the Kraft package, that was, like, fancy.
The slices are thicker.
They're thicker, you know, and they always gave us one to taste, and that was always really exciting. But so when I moved to New York, I kind of, like, you know, learned about food in general. Like, you know, falafel was a very exotic entity, and all these new things. So I traveled to visit a friend of mine who was studying abroad.
What were you studying at NYU?
I was studying art, studio art. So painting, drawing, sculpture, photo, the whole bit, just kind of dabbling in everything. And when I went to visit this friend of mine who was studying in Florence, she took me to the Central Market there, which of course was like this mind-blowing experience.
Yeah, it's crazy.
You know, everything, the cheese, the cured meats, the breads, the dried fruit, the fresh produce, it was all so incredible. And I was kind of like, huh, you know, we have all this stuff at home, but none of it tastes as amazing as any of this stuff does. So what have I been missing out on, you know? So when I came back to New York, somebody was like, oh, you've got to check out Murray's Cheese. They've got the best cheese in the city, and, you know, you can really learn about cheese there. So I started, like, going to Murray's as a student and buying cheese there, and I would be that annoying customer that we all know now who was buying, like, 8 quarter pounds of things and tasting for, like, a half hour. And
those are terrible people.
They're terrible people. I was one of them. I confess.
That's why you're so nice as a cheesemonger.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like I've been on the other side of the counter. Yeah. I remember it was that guy.
Death by a thousand paper cuts.
Yeah, exactly. So that was kind of my introduction to Murray's. And when I graduated from college with an art degree, I was like not very employable because I didn't want to be a professional artist. And I had worked in galleries and at museums and wasn't really.
You didn't like the culture there?
Yeah, no, it just wasn't really my tribe. You know, I felt like the art world was a little too highfalutin, a little too pretentious, a little too clubby, you know, and I just didn't ever really feel like I fit in, you know.
The cheese world's nothing like that.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's like full of really great, fun, generous, you know, open people. And so when I graduated, I went to Murray's and asked if I could have a job. And Amy Sisti, who was then the manager, who now works for Grafton Cheese, you know, she kind of was like very polite to me, like Amy always is, and you know,
yeah.
And but you know, didn't really call me back or anything. So I went back like probably 4 times, and I was like, listen, I was like, you know, I really don't know much about cheese, but I'm really interested, and I think I could learn fast. And I remember she asked me, if I had to pair Piave with something, what would I pair it with, you know, wine-wise? And I was like, oh, geez, I don't know what Piave is. And so I just said, like, I remember I said, oh, Sauvignon Blanc, definitely, which would be terrible.
Not good.
Not good at all.
Not a good thing.
But I guess she was like, well, at least she's trying.
At least
you know?
She knows a name of a wine.
A name of a wine. Yeah. So anyways, from there, you know, I started working there 3 days a week. I was working at a wine store the other 3 days a week. And
that was a good wine store.
It was a great wine
store.
Where'd
you work?
Yeah, Chamber Street Wines down in Tribeca.
Sure.
And yeah, those guys were great. So I feel like I just kind of stumbled into like this really awesome, you know,
combo training.
Yeah, cheese and wine combo training.
I hired a lot of people when I was a manager at Dean and DeLuca. I had a lot of people that just kept coming back like that were artists. And I feel then later in the season we wanted to do a show on that and have you come with us. I feel like, you know, there are a lot of artists that gravitated towards it. I had people come to see me 10 times mm-hmm. just to get one shift from me at mm-hmm. Dean and DeLuca because they just wanted to be around the cheese, like just to be around the stuff and like be able to handle it. They also wanted to be able to eat for free,
Yeah, as artists, you know, that comes in handy too. You're like, oh, this is all my job. It's R&D, you know, you got to try all this stuff. But well, the art thing, that's an interesting sort of segue. So when I, you know, working at Murray's, I worked there for a summer, actually with Diane. That's how I met Diane. She worked one day a week at Murray's, and that was...
Diane works one day a week everywhere.
Yeah.
That's it's my claim to fame.
365 jobs.
That's hilarious. It's very true. It's very true.
I don't like to get bored.
You know, yeah. There's so many, there's a lot of interesting things to do in New York, you know? But after a summer at Murray's, I went up to Cato Corner Farm for an internship.
In Connecticut,
yeah. I had met them at the Green Market, and they've, you know, granted me this internship, even though, you know, again, I knew nothing about cheese.
But they start a lot of people out, too.
They do.
They take a lot of people in and teach them how to make cheese there, I feel.
Yeah, yeah. No, they've got, for being just like a small mom-and-pop organization, they have a big staff, you know, and now even bigger than when I was there, but... yeah, I feel like they're able to employ a lot of people and teach a lot of people about cheese. And so when I was there, you know, in the cheese room for the first day and kind of like, you know, start to finish, you know, you walk in at 7:30 in the morning or 7, whatever, with this fluid milk. And then you walk out, you know, 8 hours later with these finished fresh wheels of cheese.
It's an amazing process to be a part of.
Yeah, it's such an amazing process. And to me, that process was akin to being in your studio making art. You know, it's like you have your raw materials, you have your means with which you transform them. Only with cheese, then the result was edible. And which is, you know, better just because it's edible, but also better because I felt like it took all of the things that I didn't like about the artwork or the art world and kind of
filtered them out.
Yeah, because everyone has taste buds. So when you're making a piece of art, you know, it could, you know, some of these things that people were doing in school were so conceptual and so out there and so boring. You know, it's just like, oh, you needed like an instruction manual to appreciate it. And you were made to feel dumb if you didn't appreciate it. But with cheese, you know, I'm like, all right, you eat it, you like it, you don't. You make a judgment call. And I love that immediacy of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that was really kind of like...
It's equal opportunity
art.
Wove
together. Yeah, edible art, equal opportunity art.
What kind of, just as an aside, what was your, like... Well, I know your artwork, but why did you love to draw and paint the things you did so much?
Well, I guess they were always kind of like quirky and personal, and I guess, you know, cheese can be like that too. Not all, you know, I feel like there are definitely different kinds of cheesemakers and different kinds of cheeses, but I feel like the ones that I always end up loving the most are kind of the ones that are a little bit off the beaten path. You know, they're not like incredibly... you know, large production cheeses. It's like the guy who's, you know, working solo in the little, you know, hut somewhere is kind of always like
Yost
being my
up
favorite.
In his little creamery up,
yeah,
in,
yeah, or,
up in his shack upstate.
Exactly, exactly. Those cheeses that, you know, and I don't want to say anything that would, you know, piss off any larger scale cheesemakers, but I feel like I definitely appreciate, yeah, that kind of...
You're a guest.
The toiling of
chance.
The individual.
This
you
is
know?
Your chance to curse a lot,
right,
and
you can
yell.
Alienate anyone.
Yeah.
Exactly. Oh, my God. I can't do it.
Yeah, you can. You can. It's in you. I know it. But so you started there at Murray's. So you worked there for a summer.
For a summer. And then I was at Cato for 6 months. And then I went back to Murray's and kind of was there for their transition from the little space to the big space on Bleecker.
Which I remember really well.
Yeah. And I didn't like the big space.
I mean, I wouldn't say it to be a jerk. I loved that little
Me too.
Cheese shop. I love that you could go in there and there was a bunch of like freaky weirdos in there and you could get these odd sandwiches. Not that you guys are... Freaky,
the sandwiches
weirdo.
Stayed odd.
Well, yeah, they did. But that was a different shop. I mean, that was just a different kind of cheese shop.
It was a real cultish kind of like neighborhood shop.
Yeah, and it fit into that neighborhood perfectly at the time that it was there. At least when I worked in and around there, I worked, worked in Soho, but I remember it just really fit into that neighborhood, that little sliver of a
and the whole
shop.
Block has changed.
It has.
The block has gone upscale.
Yeah, and it's just more, and Bleecker Street is more of like a tourist corridor in general.
It is.
You know, even more so than it was then, you know. So I just, I never really felt kind of at home in the big store, and I always thought that I'd like to do something on my own. So I left Murray's in 2004 and then traveled for about 6 months learning to make cheese and make wine. I figured, you know, I was still kind of on the cheese and wine thing and trying to kind of suss out what I wanted to do, what my business would look like. And so I went to France and made goat cheese for a couple months, and I went to Italy and made wine for a couple months. And, you know, at the end of everything, I was in France, and I was at this little cheese shop in Paris called Laurent Dubois that Hervé Mons had recommended me to.
Sure.
And it was this beautiful little jewel box of a cheese shop, and it was so simple. There was nothing in there except cheese and fresh dairy, and I kind of thought, yeah, this is it. Like, I you know, was thinking about...
Smelled right.
Yeah. No,
looked right. Just proper...
Yeah, and it was just no frills, nothing extra. You know, it was just, it was a very beautiful like store and very like cut to the core, you know. And I felt like, why would I try to kind of, you know, I was thinking, oh, wine bar, oh, you know, art gallery, oh, all these different things with cheese involved. And I was like, no.
Like,
I've got to do
I'm
just
make a
cheese.
Shop.
Yeah, I'm going to have a little cheese shop that's just full of cheese and nothing else. And so when I came back to New York, I started looking for places, and I found that little stall in the Essex Market with the help of Robert LaValva, who's a great guy.
Your own little jewel box.
Yeah. I don't know if it's a jewel box. It's like a little, it's like a, what is it? It's like a little, it's like a bric-a-brac cheese shop.
Right. You did have an art gallery next door for a while. Is it still there?
Cucci Fritos is still there.
Yeah.
Strangest place.
I mean, strangest place in the world.
That's where I met you.
Yeah.
I met you literally on the street corner there when Daphne Zeppos was like, this is Anne Saxelby. She's going to open up a shop of American cheeses.
Yeah, exactly. And you were behind the Comte counter.
Yeah, I was locked in a tiny shell with big cheeses. But I just think it's interesting to note, you know, that now if someone were to say, yeah, I opened up a shop to, you know, to sell American cheeses, people would be like, oh, yeah, well, everybody does that. But you... were the pioneer
were the
of that. You were like...
The second, I think, second. Beachers.
You're right, you're
in
right.
Seattle was first.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Yeah.
First in the city,
they
definitely.
They have only American?
They have only American.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, Beachers.
Yeah.
But, but I mean, and you never, because you're you, and I know you, but you... You know, it was a lot different than when you first opened up the American cheese scene, I guess, as it were, and the producers and everything, the entire thing. I mean, when I started to sell cheese, there was a handful. Like, I could put my hand around the number of cheeses that I could get.
Exactly.
And I feel like when you did your shop, you could put your arms around it. And now I feel like it's this vast thing. You know?
Can't even keep up with it anymore.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, it's
and they're
really
so much better.
Crazy and
well,
awesome.
That's really
better
thing.
And better.
But do you think the quality has grown with the quantity exponentially?
Yep.
That's fantastic to hear.
Yeah.
And I haven't – you think so as well.
Oh,
I mean, obviously.
Sure.
Yeah. The pillars are still there, though. I always feel like of American cheese, there's still people that will always – like, you know, like the Igvella, you know, the dry, like things like Dry Jack or Humboldt Fog or
– or even Maytag Blue.
Maytag Blue, like these things – that people sometimes take for granted now, but
realize that they've been in existence for 100 years. You know?
Yeah,
yeah,
totally.
Or maybe not 100, but you know, a long time.
A billion years. Well, as you know, we're going to have to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking more with Anne Saxelby about cheese. Thanks so much.
You are listening to Four Lincolns, Never in Love.
Someone else feels as
Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board are proud to underwrite Cutting the Curd on heritageradionetwork.org. Wisconsin cheeses have an illustrious heritage of more than 170 years of quality and craftsmanship. During this long and rich history, the art and science of cheesemaking have been captured in time-honored traditions that produce cheese varieties of unsurpassed excellence. Today, Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit www.eatwisconsincheese.com.
This is Clay Gordon of thechocolatelife.com, and you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to Cutting the Curd. Again, I'm very excited to have Overlord and Saxelby here with me in the booth, and Diane Stemple, both who predate me on the show, but somehow I'm hosting the show.
I want a t-shirt that says that, Overlord.
I can get that done for you.
That would be good. That would be good for the kids. Just yes. Be like, listen to me. I'm in charge here.
So we were talking with Anne in the first part of the show about her roots as a cheesemonger, and I knew you had gotten up to the point where you opened Saxelby Cheesemongers, which was, you know, you did your retail thing, and now you've grown into a wholesale thing. And then you started a radio show. And now what's going on? What's next for you?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I mean, right now I'm pretty busy. I have two little kids.
Congratulations.
Congrats. You're a new mama again.
New mama again, yep. So Max, my son, will be 2 in November, and my daughter Josie was just born at the end of July.
Wow.
That's so sweet.
So she's brand new. And so right now I feel like it's all – I'm just kind of like wrapped up in that, and then the business is you know, the business is growing. The wholesale side of things continues to grow, and we're just kind of focusing on that for the time being.
I mean, and, you know, for those 10 people out there that don't know, so Saxelby Cheesemongers started. I worked in the Essex market with Anne, and we were the first, I would say, some of the first merchants of our kind in that
yeah.
establishment.
Yeah, we were some of the first, like, non-Hispanic, like, new merchants.
And
yeah.
So I went in there and just tried to sell one cheese, and that was insane. I worked for the Essex Street Cheese Company, and then I was storing parts for your stand for a while.
In your phone booth size stand.
In my phone booth, and I was really happy to have something else to do. I remember you asking me, hey, do you mind if I put these boxes here? I was like, anything. Just give me anything to do, and I'll do it.
We'd sit and talk and hang out,
Oh,
too.
That was awesome.
That was like, yeah.
But you were way down at the end of the other end of the hall. So.
I know, it's true.
But it was so interesting to see the growth of your business. I remember meeting your family. I remember meeting all the Saxelbys that day.
They came for the opening, didn't they?
Yep. They come.
And I made them all do shots of whiskey with me at Boss Tweed's.
Which is legendary.
Yeah, they did not need their arms twisted for that,
no,
probably.
Yeah, they did not. They did not at all.
But you know, from there you started selling, or I mean, you had your plan. You started selling all the neighborhood restaurants, a wholesale in the LES, and then that birthed your. You have an aging facility in Red Hook, correct?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't quite call it an aging facility. I mean, I'd love to at some point get to the point where we could do some real affinage, but I would say now we've pretty much just got a big walk-in, yeah, where we try to shepherd the cheese along in the best possible condition, but. Yeah, we started by selling. I would just, you know, in the beginning, I hit up all my friends in the restaurant world at the time and people who I thought would like the local thing. Because again, you know, chefs weren't necessarily looking for local cheeses back then. You know,
they weren't at all. Actually,
another trend you were ahead of.
Well, it was just kind of funny, and then yeah, now you know people come to us pretty much every day. But you know. Back then, I remember I was like, okay, Savoy, you know, Peter Hoffman.
Absolutely.
He was somebody who I was like, okay, maybe he would go for it. And my friend Colin Alavris, who had the tasting room.
Absolutely.
Who is no longer, I'm sad that restaurant isn't around anymore. Mm-hmm. But they were two of the first. And then I remember at the time there was a woman named Molly Kaplan who was the cheese person for Gramercy Tavern.
Yeah.
She came over right away. She was really fun. So, you know, there was kind of like a handful of people who kind of started it. And then it was just growing so much to the point where, you know, we couldn't even walk in the walk-in. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have a small...
Well, for anyone who doesn't know, hasn't been there, your store is incredibly tiny.
Yeah, it's about 100...
You can fit a person in there.
Yeah, it's about 150 square feet, the entire store, and half of it's a walk-in. So,
right, you needed another space.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I remember it was hilarious. I mean, we literally couldn't walk in the walk-in. We'd have to open the door and just hope that we could reach for whatever we needed. And luckily, Benoit, my business partner, and I are both tall and have long arms. So usually we could reach what we wanted to reach, but we would prepare all these wholesale orders and then just like put them out. And then we had this delivery guy who we found on Craigslist who was he was a public defender or something during the and then between cases he would come down to the market and deliver cheese.
So
he
do like bail bondsman work,
yeah,
like maybe, and then deliver cheese in between.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It was hilarious, and he'd be in a suit, and so everyone was like, "God, you're good delivery guys in
awesome.
A suit." You know, and we're like, "Well,
that's how we roll here, yeah. At Saxony yeah. Cheesemongers."
Like, well, he's a lawyer, and he just does this for fun. You know, it was so weird. But so then eventually we're kind of like, okay, you know, it was actually we took a trip in 2009, Benoit and I, to Cheese and Bra, and Jason from Neil's Yard Dairy was so great. He picked us up in
Jason
Paris.
Jason Hines,
yep, who's
estimable.
Been
oh yeah
a guest many times as well. You know, we after kind of we took this long trip and we sort of saw all these different cheese businesses in Italy and France and in England, and we were like, okay, this is what we have to do next. We've got to build a little cave and you know, really sort of focus on this wholesale thing and see what we can make of it. Because I feel like my goal is always to, you know, be kind of a little bit of a bridge between the farm and the people eating the cheese. And so we wanted to, but just not do it in just a symbolic sense, but really sell a meaningful quantity of cheese for these farms. So we were kind of like, all right, if we want to do that, then
we got to do it.
We've got to do a wholesale business in earnest, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you must be proud of all of the work you've done. Like Diane said, like you, you did things. You did many things first, and you don't mention that a lot because you're a humble person. But you really have, and you continue to do that. And I wondered if you could just, you know, tell me, like, how does it feel just to know that you're that person?
Oh man, well I don't know that I feel that way. I mean, I feel like I. You know, it was just kind of, in a lot of ways, it was like, you know, timing is everything. I was in the right place at the right time, you know,
yeah.
And I happened to meet some really wonderful cheesemakers who were starting up just around the same time. Like, I remember back in the day working at Murray's and Jasper Hill was just getting started, you know,
yeah.
And so Mateo and Andy would come in with their cheeses and, you know, I feel like, you know, it just kind of all happened like at the same time. And I was really lucky to like be kind of at the crest
at the
of
right
the wave
place at the right time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And be able to ride it.
And you have your great personality, which helps everything. I mean, everyone likes you.
I think you're a jerk.
Thanks, Greg. Likewise. Yeah.
I'm kicking Greg. I mean, you know, you're Anne Saxelby.
Well, that's very nice of you to say. I
can tell you're nervous because you keep twisting whatever you're holding in your
I
hands.
Know. Well, you know,
too
you're
many
making
compliments.
Me uncomfortable.
No,
yeah.
I know what you're saying.
You gotta, like, let's dial back.
I wanted to ask you a question, you know, an actual question.
Okay. An actual question.
Okay, coming up.
So, you know, there's been all this hooey actual. About, you know, the FDA and wooden boards and all of this, you know, and there's just been a lot of activity going on. And I was wondering, since, you know, a lot of this has happened, you know, through this summer and you have been, you know, busy having babies and, you know, doing that kind of stuff. So your voice hasn't been heard by me, at least, as much as it, you know, as much as maybe normally would. So what do you think of all of this?
Well, I think it's kind of a scary time for American cheese and American cheesemakers because, like Diane said, you know, we've made so much progress. I mean, my shop is going to be 8 years – well, it's 8 years old. It'll be 9 years old as of next year. And, you know, it's – there's been such amazing progress in the variety and quality of cheeses made in this country. And to think that could be kind of now – hampered or destroyed by the FDA is really scary, not just because people would be, you know, losing something that's delicious, but because, you know, many people have staked their lives on the businesses that depend on these products.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so for me as a business person and as a cheesemonger, I mean, I would lament the loss of all these raw milk cheeses that would no longer be allowed. But I would also, you know, it would fundamentally alter the nature of our business because we wouldn't have nearly as much, you know, beautiful, interesting cheese to sell. It would be really tragic.
Easily.
And it would be harder on the smaller farmers.
It would be harder
to change the rules on them.
Yeah, well, and all, you know, even the equipment, you know, a pasteurizer is like $10,000 easy. So, you know, if someone wants to get into cheese making,
it's a lot of cash.
That's a lot of cash to lay out front. And it just is, you know, it's another barrier to entry.
So there's been a lot of talk around non-toxinogenic E. coli counts in raw milk cheese.
Yeah.
And I read this awesome summary someone showed me, Matteo Keeler wrote for some cheese folk in a cheese blog. For those listeners who don't know, non-toxinogenic E. coli is a common bacteria found in raw milk cheese. Like the name implies, it's non-toxinogenic, non-harmful, and in fact, it's known to impart additional flavor into the cheese. In 2009, the FDA sought to lower the limit for regulatory response to non-toxinogenic E. coli in all cheeses and offer different limits for raw and pasteurized cheeses, a significantly higher one for raw milk cheese, understandably, since raw milk naturally contains more of this delicious, creating non-toxinogenic bacteria. When the final guidance document was published in 2010, the language and standards for raw milk cheese were deleted, and the standard for pasteurized dairy products were applied to all dairy products, including raw milk cheese. So not only is this an impossible standard to meet for raw milk, no one in the cheese industry was sort of,
aware at the table.
Yeah. And so what are your thoughts about that, like that particularly?
Well, I mean, I feel like it was a big missed opportunity, you know, for, I feel like a lot of these things kind of happen behind closed doors and
like everything does.
In political situations. And I think that, you know, small scale cheesemakers don't really, they certainly don't have like a lobbying body because that costs a lot of money. And, you know, as great as organizations like the ACS and things are, it's impossible to kind of, you know, it's impossible to catch everything that's going through, although I'm sure that they knew about it. But it's also hard to spread the word and get the kind of feedback that would stop something like that from going through, you know, because we are a mighty community, but we're small, you know.
Tiny.
So to get sort of the crucial, you know, outrage, you know, the crucial mass of outrage that you would need to stop something like that, that would be, it wouldn't be impossible, but it would be tough for the cheese community to muster. So I think it's ridiculous that the regulations would be the same for pasteurized as raw milk cheeses, because that's essentially outlawing raw milk cheese without doing it explicitly.
Exactly.
And that's, you know, that's the troublesome thing. And I think I remember the standards, I believe it's like 10 colony forming units per gram of cheese.
Yep.
And in France, I think it's 100,000 colony forming units per gram of cheese. That's the regulation. So
that's a bit, that's a god. That's just like the difference.
That's impossible.
In it's, anything,
yeah.
That's
mm-hmm.
a big.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Jasper Hill, actually, I was talking to Vince from Jasper Hill, and, you know, I feel like they're on the up and up about these types of issues a lot more than other farms.
Well, probably the most. I mean,
and,
well, at least
well,
the
they've
most.
Installed a lab on their farm. I mean,
yeah.
They have the ability and the means to kind of test for these things. So they were saying, even, you know, on a good day, and they have won awards for having the cleanest milk in Vermont on several occasions, they have 23 colony forming units per gram. And that's like the cleanest milk ever. You know, the French cheese technicians who come over and kind of help them develop their cheeses from time to time, they're like, the problem is that your milk is too clean.
Yeah.
You want to...
Not tasty enough.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, though.
Yeah.
That's... sterilization of everything of our society. I mean, no, that's a big thing. That's just where we're headed. That's where we're headed on a whole.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
And I feel like people like Michael Pollan have started, you know, trumpeting that a little bit. I really liked that article that he wrote a couple months ago about the microbiome and how important that is, and all these
Absolutely.
Bacteria that we take for granted and that we don't know what they do. And I really feel like, yeah, the over sterilization thing is a
little
big problem.
Bugs run the god darn universe. They're all inside us, all around us, on us, everywhere. That's just how it is.
Yeah,
you know,
and it's
I mean?
Certainly rules and regulations have their place, certainly.
You
but
gotta
you
have,
have to be it has to be based in science and in things that are reasonable, not just
well, that's be common
pasteurization
sense.
Standards.
Yeah, the science is a tool, you know, that's used in my I'm a terrible person because I feel like we aren't defined by, like, science doesn't define us. We use it, you know, as a tool to define the things that are around us. And that's just how I see the world.
Well, sure. And oftentimes people who publish scientific, findings are, you know, like companies who publish scientific findings, they pay these researchers to kind of, you know, it's always skewed, let's say. You know, it's always skewed. The research that you see is always skewed in the favor of the person who wants it.
Absolutely.
Who sponsored it, you know?
Of course. It's like a poll in a Republican newspaper saying that Barack Obama is a terrible, you know, they're only polling their readers. You know?
Sure.
And I get that. Yeah, it's frightening. It's frightening to think that that's the way that we're going. But it's good that there are people speaking out against it, and it's coming to a head. I know Diane and I both saw that at the ACS this year.
The FDA spoke at ACS at the business meeting, and the guy who spoke was quite reasonable.
He
respectful,
he
reasonable, seemed to have listened to the meeting the day before. It felt collegial. I can't pronounce that word.
Collegial?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it felt to me like this. There's a guy was like, holy shit, these guys are like serious about what they do.
That's
like,
not
they,
just a bunch of like, you know,
Yahoos.
Yokels in garages making cheese.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, like there's about 2,000 people staring me down in this room that look
who
like
they paid
wanna,
a lot of money to be here,
yeah.
who are representing this industry.
And they look like they want to eat my face if I say the wrong thing because, you know, I'm going to take away
that
their livelihood.
That would be really scary to be in that situation. Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, I think we are running out of time, but I wanted
to... So you'll have to come back.
Yeah.
Okay. Twist my arm. Come back anytime.
Well, thank you so much, Anne and Diane, both for coming on and for being here with me. And, you know, I thank you, Anne, for bestowing upon me the awesome job of hosting Cutting the Curd. And so I want you all to stay tuned for another episode. Next week, we'll be broadcasting live from the Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.